Hi, this is Lisa Plyme calling. I'm a co-chair of the NPA-FDA Task Force, and we are absolutely delighted tonight to have Vinay Prasad with us to speak. He is a hematologist-oncologist who specializes in lymphoma clinically at Oregon Health and Sciences University in Portland. So I'm happy to have him in our neighborhood since I'm in Seattle. Vinay, in terms of his education, got his bachelor's at Michigan State, where he gave the commencement address, then did his MD at the University of Chicago, where he got the Chairman's Award in Internal Medicine, did his IM residency at Northwestern in Chicago, where he was best teacher as a resident, and then did his oncology fellowship at the NIH and was a cancer prevention fellow there, and got his MPH recently at Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. And he's just now moved this just recently to Oregon, where they have a lot of money from Nike to have
a state
cancer center. Vinay is the author of over 100 peer-reviewed journal articles and is co-author of a book called Ending Medical Reversal, Improving Outcomes and Saving Lives, that was put out by Hopkins Press recently. His research interests include oncology drugs, health policy, evidence-based medicine, bias, public health, preventive medicine, and medical reversals. So his interests really align with ours in the NPA and particularly on our task force. And I think medical reversals is something we haven't really talked about, but it refers to the fact that many medical practices which we use for a long period of time are then subsequently shown not to work. And if you go back and look at them, this is particularly likely to occur if we adopt new treatments based on incomplete or inadequate studies. So without further ado, I want to introduce Vinay Prasad, who is going to be speaking about what does it take to trust a surrogate in cancer.
Oh, thank you so much, Lisa. That was a very kind introduction, and I think, yeah, you did a great job summarizing my interests, and especially the stuff we've done on medical reversal. And so I guess let me start with the disclosure slide. So actually, that book is actually my only financial disclosure, and if you consider how many hours we spent working on it and how much we've been paid, I think it will make you aspire for minimum wage. That's it. So I guess I will talk to you all tonight a little bit about – and can everyone hear me okay? Hello?
Yes.
Okay.
That's great.
Okay. So I'm going to talk to you about the lay of the land in cancer drug approval, because I think you need to know a few sort of baseline facts before we can move into discussing surrogates. I'm going to talk a little bit about how surrogates are or should be validated in cancer, and then some of maybe the policy implications from this. So moving forward, cancer drug development. So obviously there's tremendous interest in drug development in cancer medicine. In the last year, we've had 16 new molecular entities. We've probably had another 10 secondary approvals on top of it. This is more than any other field of medicine. So I think that if you look at drug development pipelines by company, you find that probably the lion's share of drug development is in oncology. Oncology has become a field where, you know, if you have an indication for which 1,000 people in the United States have the disease annually, you can expect to have a $1 billion drug. So the days of the blockbuster drugs being, you know, Lipitor and Nexium, those days are over. Now, even with the niche markets, we can have, blockbuster drugs. And, of course, oncology is projected to grow. This is just one analysis projecting worldwide sales by therapeutic area. In terms of drugs, we're already in the head, but it's projected that we'll be even higher as more drugs come down the pipeline. If you look at the top-selling cancer drugs based on global revenue, you'll see that, you know, these drugs are making large amounts of money, $6 billion for Avastin, $6 billion for Rituxan. Gleevec, a drug in the middle, made about $4 and then $5 billion. And ironically, this is a drug that's really pursued for just two very small indications, CML and gastrointestinal stromal tumor. And Novartis, you know, many years ago in the late 90s, they didn't even want to fund the clinical trial thinking they would never make $100 million a year, and now they make about $4 to $5 billion a year. you know, interestingly, the market for cancer drugs appears to be different than most financial markets in the sense that does competition lower prices? And I think the answer is a resounding no. We've had several drugs next in class coming into different market shares in oncology, and the price has just risen. So, you know, this graph shows the average cost per day of Gleevec, which is imatinib, which is used for chronic myeloid leukemia in 2006. Nilotinib, the next-in-class drug, was approved. Then just a year later, dasatinib was approved. Now we have six drugs approved to treat CML, and the price for Gleevec has just gone up. So I think people who argue that me-too drugs are good because they drive down price, that I don't think there's been an example of that in oncology, at least in the last decade. So, you know, I guess one of the things we looked at right off the bat was we wanted to know, do rational factors predict the price of drugs? So, you know, what drives the price of drugs? So I guess the two distinctions I want to draw here is first, if you look at drugs that are approved by the FDA, some are novel. They fight cancer through a novel mechanism of action. Some are next in class or me-too drugs. They're the second or third or fourth, or in the case of renal cancer, the eighth drug that's coming on the market that works by the same putative mechanism. The other thing you should know is how are cancer drugs approved by the FDA? And this is a bit of a simplification, but it tends to hold true, which is drugs are approved usually on the basis of one of three things. Response rate, which is a measure of tumor shrinking or some reduction in the volume or size or number of cancer cells. Progression-free survival, which is a composite endpoint where the two events are progression, which is the growth of tumor past an arbitrary cutoff line, which is usually 120% from the nadir volume, or death. And there's other sort of variants of PFS, like disease-free survival, which is what you look at in the adjuvant setting when you've presumably removed all the cancer and there's nothing to follow except the recurrence of disease. And then the final endpoint is overall survival. So I think you could probably divide all approvals into one of these three things. So let me just give you a little more clarity on what is response rate and what is PFS. This will tie to both our discussion of drug cost and our discussion of surrogacy. So what is response rate? Response rate typically means for a solid tumor, at least, and of course, there's a range of response rate criteria based on the cancer and the particular situation. But for solid tumor, it usually means a complete resolution of all masses you could see in the body, plus a normalization of lymph node size to 1 to 1.5 centimeters on the long axis, and that's considered a complete response. Then there's something called a partial response, which is usually like a 50% shrinkage in the size of the target lesions and some reduction in the size of the lymph nodes. And the sum of the number of people who have had a complete response and the number of people who've had a partial response, that is the response rate. So what does response rate tell you? It tells you how active a drug is. So if you have a drug that can give you a response rate in 40% of people, 50% of people, that in our field is a pretty good measure of activity. But actually we've had recently FDA approving drugs where there is no single agent response rate. The drug by itself doesn't have any activity. And I think I'll talk a little bit later why you may start to ask a little bit more questions in those cases. So what is progression-free survival? Progression-free survival is either death or if the target lesions, which you'll see in figure B, they shrink from the left to the right in the liver, and if they grow from where they are in the right, the lower right figure to, 120% that size, that's And so I think I want to draw this distinction because people think response rate is the cancer going away and progression-free survival is the cancer growing. That's actually incorrect. Response rate is the cancer shrinking past an arbitrary threshold, and progression-free survival is the cancer growing past an arbitrary threshold. But the cancer can shrink and not be a response, and it can grow and not meet PFS. And so I think this is a distinction that the lay media needs to sort of be educated about because you can have a guy whose cancer is 119% and another guy who's had 121, and one is has progressed and one hasn't, but, you know, you'd be hard-pressed to say what's the difference between the two. And, of course, you should know, patients don't usually feel progression. It's an arbitrary line in the sand. Some patients do feel better when their cancer shrinks, so maybe there is something to that in response rate. So one of the things we looked at in the last year and a half was, and we published this in JAMA Oncology, was we looked at if you got the price of the last 60 or so drugs approved by the FDA, you'll find most of them are well over $100,000 per year of treatment or course of treatment. And if you looked at the number that are next in class and the number that are novel, you'll find 60% in the lower right are next in class and 40% are novel. And if you asked yourself, is there a difference in price between those two sets of drugs, you'd find that there's actually no difference at all between those two. The next thing we looked at was, if you looked at the same set of drugs, how many are approved on the basis of survival, how many are response rate, how many are PFS, and it really is about a third, a third, a third. And this is still sort of the case, even if you – our data set was 09 to 2013, but if you brought it forward 2 years, it would be about the same. And we asked you know, is there a difference in price based on the level of evidence that warranted approval? And I think you would arguably believe that response rate drugs should be the lowest price because that's sort of the most, you know, putative thing. It doesn't, you know, that may or may not correlate with living longer or feeling better, which are the only two patient-centered endpoints in this game. Progression-free survival may cost a little bit more, and overall survival should maybe cost the most because those have been really robustly demonstrated to improve survival. And in, paradoxically, what we found was overall survival drugs cost about $109,000 per year of treatment. PFS drugs were $108,000, and response rate drugs were $160,000. So actually, paradoxically, they cost the most. And then we looked at within the drugs that were approved based on PFS and within the drugs in the lower panel that were approved based on overall survival, is there a correlation between the percentage improvement in overall survival and the price? So if you double survival or triple survival, you know, are you priced more than if you merely improve it, you know, some marginal fraction like 10% longer? And what we found was actually the R-squares here are very poor, and these are not statistically significant, that there is really no correlation between the efficacy the price. And so I think, you know, collectively this paper that came out of JAMA Oncology had argued that cost of drugs is not explained by the novelty, and novelty may be, you know, a surrogate for R&D costs. It's not explained by the regulatory endpoint, and it's not explained by the percentage improvement in the endpoint. So we conclude, you know, the price of the drug is based only on what the market will bear. So how good are new cancer drugs? So this is something else that will give you some perspective. But this is a figure that came out in a paper in the last year where the authors looked at the last 71 consecutive drug approvals in solid tumor between 2002 and 2014. And what they found was that the median improvement in progression-free survival in the top graph is 2.3 months, and the median improvement in overall survival is 2.1 months. So the drugs we've approved in the last decade are very marginal drugs. Many of these, you'll see there's no bar at all because those are the drugs that, you know, we don't even have PFS or overall survival data. And when we do have the data, there are marginal drugs. So I think people who have this misconception that, you know, the FDA is not approving innovative drugs that are going to, you know, change our lives, but the truth is that the drugs they do approve that even make it through their, you know, vetting process, they're very marginal. Meanwhile, we have a drug industry and a machinery that's just generating, you know, ridiculous press releases and enthusiasm for drugs. We published this in JAMA Oncology just about a month ago, where we looked at all of the instances that somebody talked about a cancer drug in the lay journalism, and they used the word miracle, home run, game changer, groundbreaking, cure. And we found that there was, you know, almost 100 instances of these words used in just a short period of time. And 50% of the time, the word was used in conjunction with a drug that did not have FDA approval. And in 14% of the time, the word was used to describe a drug that had never been given to a human being. It was based solely on cell culture and mouse data. And we know in oncology that that is an extremely unreliable way to predict what actually works. Of 1,000 drugs that work in mice, maybe, you know, one will actually succeed in a human being. And so I liken it to, you know, doing a news story about a drug that shrinks tumors in mice is akin to doing a news story about a guy who buys a lottery ticket and you ask him what he's going to do with his money. No one really believes he's going to win. Although that, I say that, but now since the recent Powerball, I did see a lot of stories about that. So, you know, maybe there is some consistency here. And so, you know, just to touch on this point, which is that, you know, of course, randomized trials are our best way to make causal claims. But in oncology, there are ways in which, you know, bias can be inserted into even randomized controlled trials. And so, you know, I made this figure for a paper we had over the summer where we talked about the ways in which bias exists in trials. And we talked about, we spent a lot of time talking about bias in the bottom, bias in the coding of adverse effects, bias in the measurement or coding of outcomes, bias in selective reporting or statistical analysis or spin. And I think there's this big push for data sharing, and that's incredibly important, and it's really going to help the bottom part of this graph. But in oncology, we have a tremendous amount of bias in the top part of this figure, bias in the choice of clinical questions, bias in the choice of controls, blinding endpoints, inclusion or exclusion criteria. And this bias is hardwired bias. Even if you had the data set after the fact, you cannot correct for this bias, and that's quite common in oncology. And I would say part of this is the use of surrogate endpoints as the primary endpoint is a type of potential bias that is hardwired into clinical trials. So, you know, we all know about surrogate endpoints being misleading in different fields. Lower A1C was not better in the ACCORD and ADVANCE trial. Cholesterol levels were improved with extended-release niacin and fenofibrate, but, you know, cardiovascular outcomes were no different. There's a great paper by Lars Hemkins and colleagues in the Canadian Medical Journal where they found hospitalization, which is partly a patient-centered outcome because all things being equal, you don't want to be hospitalized, but it's also partly a surrogate because people use hospitalization and bandy it around as if it will mean reduction in mortality. And actually, Hemkins and colleagues looked at hospitalization and mortality, and they found that if you look at it across every trial where it's been reported, a third of the time they're discordant. So there may be some drugs that do decrease hospitalization, but paradoxically worsen mortality or vice versa. And so I think this sort of just draws attention to the fact that, you know, at least in part, hospitalization may be used as a surrogate. And then I talked about increased blood flow, but I'll skip that. So I just want to mention this is a trial called Look Ahead, which is a randomized controlled trial of really old type 2 diabetics who are overweight, and they randomized them to a diet and weight loss intervention, and they showed in the intervention group a tremendous reduction in weight, in improvement in physical fitness, a reduction in waist circumference, an improvement in glycosylated hemoglobin. This was a $100 million NHLBI study, but when it looked at the primary endpoint of composite cardiovascular events, there was no difference. And the reason I should look ahead is because, you know, it's easy to pick on the industry and it's easy to pick on the surrogates that we, you know, we doubt. But, you know, even things that we think are really beneficial, like diet and exercise, you know, even those surrogates of weight loss, which we think are great surrogates, you know, they can be misleading. So I think, like, surrogates should always be taken with a grain of salt, even when they're surrogates we like. And to be honest, maybe look ahead will show some improvement in quality of life. And so, you know, it will ultimately be vindicated. You know, they're still doing secondary analyses. But, I just show that to show that surrogates are sort of everywhere and they're sort of sacred cows often. So, you know, in oncology, surrogates have made a distinct rise. So in the left side of this figure, you see based on the decade of oncology clinical trials, we've seen a steady increase in the sample size of clinical trials, and that has correlated with a steady increase in the percent of trials that receive industry support. So you may be saying, and this is the cardinal rule of evidence-based medicine, that bigger randomized trials are better than smaller randomized trials, and so this is a good thing. The industry is funding the trials, and they're getting bigger, and that's good. But in oncology, bigger randomized trials means you can detect statistically significant but clinically meaningless benefits, and the worst case of that is a 10-day benefit in survival with erlotinib in pancreatic cancer. And so I would argue that in late-stage metastatic cancer, where the majority of people are going to die in a year to 2 years, you don't need a randomized trial with more than 200 people. If you don't detect a benefit, whatever benefit you're missing, your type 2 error, it's not going to be a big deal. It's going to be a marginal benefit. So we should do more trials, smaller trials, and we should look for real benefits, and we should abandon drugs that don't meet that bar. The other thing this figure shows is that if you look at the endpoints of clinical trials, from the 90s to the 2000s, we've seen a shift in endpoint from survival, which is down, and time-to-event endpoints like progression-free survival are up. So the industry is doing bigger trials. They're powering them for smaller benefits, and they're using time-to-event endpoints rather than survival. Okay, and, you know, the great seminal example of why you should be a little cautious about surrogates in cancer is Avastin in breast cancer. So Avastin breast cancer was approved in 2009, propelled on the results of a clinical trial called E2100, where it had a 6-month improvement in progression-free survival when added to taxane chemotherapy in first-line metastatic breast cancer. It was given an accelerated approval, so they had to do post-marketing efficacy studies, and then they found in those studies, Ribbon and Novato, that the PFS benefit was much smaller than initially believed. It was about 2 2 months. And the overall survival in all three trials was no different whether you got Avastin or not. And Avastin is a toxic drug. It has real side effects. So a toxic drug that doesn't improve survival, that does improve a surrogate, that's not just a debatable drug, in my opinion. That's a harmful drug. It doesn't improve what patients care about. And the ODAC revoked it in 2012, and it was an extremely contentious process. And I think getting – and the irony now is bevacizumab for this use is still recommended by the NCCN, which is a compendia. And if you're in the NCCN compendia, by law, Medicare must pay for the drug. So Avastin is revoked by the FDA, but remains by law has to be paid for by Medicare, which is just a perverse situation. So, you know, in the early part of this year, we did a really broad meta-analysis where we looked at, you know, in every single tumor type, in every single stage from, you know, early stage cancer to late stage cancer, for every single surrogate endpoint, like response rate, progression-free survival, disease-free survival, molecular hematologic response, you know, we looked to see what is the available literature show for the correlation between the change in the, between improving the surrogate and improving survival. So in other words, under what settings is improving the surrogate really reliable? So let me just give you a background. You can imagine that a researcher comes across a set of clinical trials in a field, and they find, for instance, in one trial, the progression-free survival in one arm was 3 months and the other arm was 6.4 months. The overall survival was 18 months in that same arm, and there was 20. Another clinical trial has these following results, 1 month and 2 months, 12 months and 13 months. So a researcher may do a meta-analysis of all the literature on cancer surrogates and may pick out these two trials and many others, and they may do the following. They may plot, they may say that, like, hey, this group of people that had a PFS of 3.4 months, they lived 18 months, so they're this triangle. The group of people that had a PFS of 6.4 months, they lived 12 months, so they're this triangle. The one-month group lived 12 months, so they're this dot. And the two-month group lived 13 months, they're this dot. And so what they're doing here is they're taking each arm of a randomized study, and the x-coordinate is a surrogate and the y-coordinate is survival. They're plotting them on a x-y axis, and they're performing linear regression. And what they're asking is, in a cohort of patients, does progression-free survival predict subsequent overall survival? This is called a level, you know, we didn't invent these terms. There's a whole literature on how do you validate surrogates, and this is called a level 2 validation study. It's not the peak pinnacle of validation. It tells you if, on average, cohorts where progression occurs later live longer. And, you know, that's useful, but it doesn't quite get to the question of should you approve drugs based on whether or not they improve PFS. So what we found is when you look at the literature, you find a whole bunch of level 2 analyses, but they kind of miss the point in terms of whether or not drug approval should be contingent on changes in the surrogate. But instead, if what you plot was the following, if you made the if you noted in the above figure that you know, PFS was extended 3 months and survival was extended 3 months. In the bottom, PFS was extended 1 month and survival was extended 1 month. And if you plot the change in progression-free survival against the change in overall survival, you get for two trials, each trial becomes one data point. And if you did this for many, many trials in the field, you perform linear regression, you would get a sort of you would get a correlation coefficient. I've shown it here as a correlation coefficient, but you could also look at it as an R squared. But what you find is, and the German Institute of the ICQUIG, German Institute of Quality, they have issued guidelines for, you know, what is a reliable surrogate for clinical decision making and drug approval, and what is the kind of correlation you would need to see in this type of analysis. This is called a level one analysis. And what they plot were the following. 0.85 is a very strong, 0.7 to 0.85 is medium, and less than 0.7 is weak. And, you know, you may say less than 0.7, that's still pretty good, but if you think about it, that goes with an R squared of about 0.5, which tells you that only half of the variation in the change in survival is explained by the change in the surrogate. So I think when you really get to that level, you can have a lot of drugs of Avastin level that actually, you know, would, you know, the indication would have an R squared of 0.49, but individual drug approval would be very uncertain. It would be a very uncertain business to be in. So what did we do? So we looked at the entire literature. We only looked at type 1 analyses. We excluded all type 2 analyses. And we asked the question of, you know, whether or not what is the correlation on average in all these settings? But before I get to that, let me tell you the first thing we looked at. The first thing we looked at was, where do the authors of surrogate validation studies get their data from? Do they get it from, they don't tell us, not provided, not clear? Do they get it from a convenience sample? These were 8 randomized trials that we're aware of. Do they get it from a systematic review of published articles? We looked at a systematic review of all the trials in non-small cell lung cancer, first line. Did they extend that systematic review to include meeting abstracts? And did they do what I think you really need to do, which is look at published articles, meeting abstracts, and trial registries? So the reason this matters is, of course, there's selective reporting bias in the literature, and selective reporting bias may paradoxically inflate correlations of surrogacy, because the studies that we're not pursuing are ones where the PFS or OS was disappointing, and those may actually erode the claim of surrogacy, of strength of surrogacy. And what we found was very few authors were making the robust attempt to try to look through all the databases. We also found that even if you were in this tail on the right side, you were one of these few articles where they did survey all the literature and the unpublished literature, we found that they were not able to actually get all the articles, and they were still relying on an average 50% of the trials. So the entire field of surrogate validation in cancer, while we're probably ahead of, you know, cardiovascular disease or, you know, because, you know, people care about this question and there are a lot of trials, but the entire field is based on a very selected subset of the literature, and, you know, it's very questionable how reliable even the validated surrogates are. So, but the truth is that it turns out to be not a big issue because most of the surrogates are not validated. So on the left figure, you see in the neoadjuvant setting, which is chemotherapy administered before surgery, most of the settings where that's done, the surrogate endpoint, which is sort of a pathologic response of, you know, all the cells dying, those poorly correlate with survival. In the adjuvant setting, this is the one setting where actually, you know, a lot of times the surrogate does correlate with survival, but we have to be very clear what this surrogate is. This surrogate is disease-free survival, which means if you had breast cancer, we cut out the cancer, and we treated you with the drug, people in whom the cancer did not recur, they really do live longer. Actually, I shouldn't have used breast cancer. That's one of the ones where it's a poor correlation, but I should have used lung cancer. In lung cancer, if your lung cancer doesn't come back, you really do live longer. If your colon cancer doesn't come back, you really do live longer. But you should know that the disease-free survival, it's not a great surrogate because overall survival, you know, you could detect that at 5 years. Disease-free survival, you'll detect it at 3 years. So it shaves off very little time, and that may be why it's actually a reliable surrogate, because it's very close to the actual harder endpoint. In the metastatic setting, so for tumors that have already spread away from where they originally start, the majority of the correlations between progression-free survival or tumor shrinkage and overall survival are very, very poor. They're so poor that, you know, they would be insufficient to base clinical or regulatory decisions on. Let me go to the next one. And so why does this matter? So the other analysis we did in JAMA Internal Medicine just about a month ago was we looked at, you know, if you get a drug approved based on a surrogate, it turns out that, you know, half of those approvals are traditional approvals. They're full approvals, so that the drug will never be pulled off the market, even if you find that it doesn't work to improve survival or quality of life. And I think the FDA has deliberately moved towards giving more traditional approvals based on surrogates because of the E2100 and bevacizumab story. They don't like when drugs come off the market. It's too contentious. It draws too much attention. It's better to just approve it and not ever revisit the issue. And what we found was if you looked at 5 years of cancer drug approvals and you follow them out into the future, later shown overall survival benefits, how many have been tested for survival but did not show benefits, and how many have never been tested again, and we found just a fraction of drugs, 5 out of 36, showed overall survival on the back end, and the majority were either untested or they were tested and they didn't work. Okay, so I'm getting to the end. So the last 2 points I want to make is, why don't these surrogates work to predict survival? Well, it turns out you can manipulate the heck out of a surrogate. So this was an analysis we did of a trial called Bolero, which looked at the addition of everolimus to exemestane in early-stage hormone-receptor-positive breast cancer. And what we found was the dark lines here, the dark blue and the dark red, those are the survival curves from the actual study. the dotted blue lines and the dotted red lines and the light solid blue line and the light solid red line, what you're seeing here is, I guess what you're seeing is that, you know, the survival curve could be so high or it could be so low. These are sensitivity analyses we did. And what did we look for? We asked a simple question. If you give one of these cancer drugs to a patient and that patient has toxicity that's so bad they cannot come back for visits, those patients are censored. And in Bolero, there's a ton of censoring because this drug is very toxic. And what we said was the assumption of Kaplan-Meier is that censored patients are as likely to experience the event of interest as those who are uncensored. That's the fundamental assumption. But that assumption is likely incorrect in cases of toxic cancer drugs, and the patients who are censored are probably more likely to experience the event of interest. And so we plot here, based on how many patients are censored at each time point, how good could the survival curve be, assuming that they all did well, and how bad could it be, assuming that they all did poorly. And we show that under these assumptions, you can easily show the curves cross. And you can do this for many studies, and I think that's part of why you know, these surrogates don't work well in cancer. And then the last thing I'll say is the clinical trials in cancer, they look nothing like real patients. The average age of our cancer patients is about a decade younger in clinical trials than the real world. They have fewer comorbidities. This was a nice analysis from the Kaiser group where they took two inclusion criteria from current lung cancer studies and applied it to their cohort of patients. And they said that if you took those inclusion criteria and you applied it to all Kaiser lung cancer cases, only 20% of lung cancer cases would be eligible based on stage would actually be eligible based on the inclusion criteria. And so I think what does this tell us? This tells us that these drugs that are marginal and very toxic are toxic and marginal in healthy people. When you actually use them in people who are older with real comorbidities and, you know, real disease in the real world, I'm sure that I suspected that they're actually, and not only do I suspect it, there's a whole bunch of data that shows it, that they're less efficacious, they're more toxic, and the risk-benefit balance may shift. And so, and this is proven in this nice analysis showing that hospitalization for patients getting lung cancer chemotherapy in the real world versus clinical trials, it's much more in the real world. So, you know, what's the takeaway message about this is that, you know, we're arguing about surrogates and we're arguing about survival, and but we're doing it in a very specific setting. In the real world, these drugs are probably way worse, and I think that some of them, you know, if you tested in a pragmatic randomized trial, I don't think they would be approved. And everolimus breast cancer is one of them. I think it has no benefit to patients, and if you tested in real people, even the spurious surrogate benefit would vanish. So surrogates in cancer, they're used commonly. They have misled. I think they can be manipulated. I think there's a pipeline of people in academics and the FDA who go to work for the industry. And if you're smart and you understand this stuff, I think you can give you can design a trial that will, with any toxic drug that is zero efficacy against a cancer, you can show a PFS benefit and get approval and have a couple billion dollars. I think that is, I think one could actually purposefully do this if one wanted to. I'm not saying that that's what's being done. I'm just saying that, you know, it's a potential temptation, and I think that the way the incentives are drawn and the way trials are conducted, it probably is being done to some degree. So I think if they continue to be used, they should be done very cautiously, only in those rare settings where they have been validated. And we have another paper looking at how are they actually used compared to how they're validated, and the answer is quite simply they're used way more than they've been validated. So I think that's my talk.
Very impressive and scary.
Yeah.
No, at this point we have we should have some time for questions. That was really, really interesting. And it's so parallel to what we've talked about with other drugs like antibiotics, the same kinds of things that John has talked about quite a bit with us.
Well, you know, it's interesting, Vina. After you put out your letter, I had our librarian here at NIH run the same search that you did, except replaced oncology with infectious diseases.
Sure.
We found zero level one trial level meta-analyses on surrogate endpoints in infectious diseases other than HIV.
So, wow.
You have 37, because we have one.
Right.
So,
yeah.
But I think that's an important point, is that people, that difference that you pointed out between a level one trial level meta-analysis, which asks the question, if the drug changes the surrogate, does it improve the direct patient outcome? Versus, there's people, if your, you know, FEV1 gets better with your pulmonary drug, then you're less likely to die. That's not the right question. It's if you alter it with a drug, does that drug make you live longer? And I think that distinction gets lost.
Right. We know that people with low blood pressure have less cardiovascular events, but the question is, if I give them a blood pressure medicine, does I lower cardiovascular events? And that's true for some classes, but maybe not beta blockers, you know, that sort of thing, yeah.
Exactly. And that, and what you hear when people get up and defend surrogates, they talk about that first one, the patient level.
Yeah, the cohort.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, not the trial level effect of a drug. And that
right.
really gets lost in the wash.
I agree with that, yeah. And I think that, like I said, that I think oncology, we are better because, I mean, better in the sense they're more, you can do a literature search and find 37 things. Like, you know, yeah, I'm not surprised you can't, you know, they're not that many. But, and then, you know, if you think about the, it's kind of sobering because you think, like, this is the field where we're doing a ton of this stuff. And actually, not just where people are, academics are doing it. There are companies that the purpose of the company is to validate these things, and they're hired by the industry to validate it, and they do the analysis, and they, you know, they work to get these results. But even when they do it under all those conditions, you can still find the overall body of literature is very weak correlation, which is sobering.
So one other question I would have is Louis Jacques gave us a talk, I guess, about a year ago, and one of his suggestions as a solution to this is something you kind of raised. Should there be differential pricing for drugs that are approved based on surrogates versus not? And should there, mm-hmm. instead of being this FDA has to actively take the drug off the market, should there be a sunsetting provision that if a company hasn't validated the surrogate after a certain period of time, mm-hmm. the drug should be automatically withdrawn?
That's a great point, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the answer to both those questions is, there should be a provision. I mean, the post-marketing commitment should have teeth. If they're not met in a certain time, they should be pulled. And actually, remind me again, what was the first point?
Should there be differential pricing for these drugs when you brought up that there isn't?
Yeah, so I think, like, you know, I mean, what's the solution in the U.S.? In the U.K., they have, and we have a paper about NICE pricing. And so in the U.K., they can do that a little bit. So they can say, look, you know, we're going to pay, you know, of all the drugs that improve overall survival, if you improve overall survival and you cost less than, you know, $66,000 per quali, we're going to pay for. For all the drugs that improve a surrogate, you can submit your modeling study, and we can look at it critically, and we can say, like, do we really think this is going to save, you know, this is going to prolong life at $66,000 a quality, and if so, fund it. And when you apply those criteria in the UK and NICE, what they find is that most of the drugs that improve these surrogates, they do reject, actually, because the modeling studies have huge confidence intervals, and they could easily be cost-effective or, you know, 20 times not cost-effective. And the overall survival drugs, you know, many of them are approved, but many others are not approved. And so then we have something saying that, like, you know, it's actually sobering when you compare the two countries, because in our country, we're talking about, like, should we be using lenalidomide for 5 years after initial treatment of myeloma, which is, like, so far beyond what the UK is considering. They're considering the question of should they use it at all in induction, which is, you know, so much, you know, in this country, there'd be very little disagreement on that question. And I think what that tells us is that if there were such a system that priced based on what these drugs actually do, I think very few of them would be paid for over all of the other things we could be doing in healthcare that will improve people's quality of life and, you know, that sort of thing.
Can I come in there? It's Ruth here. We do that in Australia as well, of course. And a lot of drugs that are considered for reimbursement on the basis of surrogate endpoints do not make it to, or if they do, the prices are significantly suppressed relative to the US price, and we do have pricing by indication. But it's interesting listening to your presentation because it resonates so strongly with my own experience. 15 years ago, I did a study looking at decision-making in a national formulary committee and the extent to which the decision-making relied on either poorly validated or completely invalidated surrogate endpoints and what was at stake financially. Was part of what I was looking at. Since then, in Australia, the guidelines for the evaluation of medicines and reimbursement have significantly stoked up the requirements for modelling studies where surrogate endpoints are proffered, and of course, clinical endpoint data is preferred. But time and time and time again, the data we get are driven by the data that the FDA has accepted as adequate or reasonable, and that's all we have to work with. So we have to rely on surrogate endpoint data and try to make the best of it. But as you say, you may get lots of drugs that look for which the point estimate of the cost effectiveness ratio looks fine, but the uncertainty because of the uncertainty in the relation between the surrogate and the clinical endpoint is so great that the uncertainty overwhelms the estimate of cost effectiveness, and the committee just
says,
no way. So
So I do understand that, you know, a lot of countries are limited because, you know, the companies are going after the U.S. FDA, and so they appealed. So, you know, the company is not going to give, you know, may some countries more data than what they give the FDA, for instance. So I think that the FDA, you know, I think they're under tremendous pressure, and there's this article, I don't know if anyone saw in the New York Times, about how you know, the FDA cancer drug czar, quote unquote, Rick Pazdur, you know, how his wife passed away of cancer, and how, you know, he's speeding things up, and he's, you know, becoming more accepting of surrogates. That's what the New York Times article kind of covered. But I think the truth is, if you looked at the approvals over the last decade, actually, you know, he's been pretty consistent. He's really embraced surrogates, and he's been pushing drugs. He's actually not a very he's not very restrictive in terms of drug approval, and I think the tempo of the administration of the FDA is to approve more drugs faster with more surrogates and smaller studies. And I think what that will do globally is way more uncertainty. So I think this problem would just get worse based on the way it's going.
I agree.
And we have concern with the new FDA commissioner, too, coming on board, that there may be more of that as well.
Yeah, and I know that Bob Califf has, like, sent a note out saying that if only all the divisions could do the same what Oncology Drug Products has done, you know, we'd all be better off. But I think, we would definitely be worse off if they all go in this direction. And actually, I think the real thing that I have sort of picked up in doing in our looking at this is this: the use of traditional drug approval, full approval based on surrogates, is really has created a situation where there is going to be a big void in studies that look at survival for so many drugs. And, you know, it's one thing if we have this accelerated approval and we can look at it later, and then we can have these fights like Avastin and draw the attention to this problem. But if you don't look at it again, you know, people will believe what they want to believe, and you won't be able to disprove that some of these drugs don't help.
Right. And I think that's a good segue for us to move on to the business part of our meeting, if that's okay, unless there's somebody who has a burning question left. Okay. And Vinnie, you are welcome to stay with us, because we're going to be talking about some of the actions that we want to take really relate directly to what you've just been discussing with your talk. And so first of all, what I would like to do, first, did anybody else join the call who didn't tell us at the beginning?